Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. But I'm also co-host of another podcast, and this month we're crossing them over. So roll that beautiful disco intro music.
My witch's brew! Witch's brew! Boil and bubble! Put a fire in the stove! Witch's brew! Toil and trouble!
Well, welcome back, everybody, to Take Me to Your Reader, discussing adapted science fiction at its best and worst. I'm Seth.
I'm James.
And I'm Colin.
And we are crossing over this month with the Hugo's There podcast. And
who are you calling? That sounds like you said calling.
This is how it goes here, people. Just letting you know. And it just so happens that the most recent winner of the Retro Hugo for best novel, Conjure Wife by Fritz Lieber, is also adapted into three films. And so that's why it made sense for us to cover it on Take Me to Your Reader. And so I've had Colin before as a guest on the Hugo's There podcast.
That's
I have
me.
Not yet had Mr. James Ralston.
That's him.
That would be me.
Yes.
Maybe.
So one of the things
as
that,
long as I believe it's me.
Correct.
Do you believe?
Do you mean,
do
you believe?
Do we need to warn our listeners about the content of this podcast?
with a black screen?
Yes. 4-minute voiceover. We invoke the spirits of Ellison, and Asimov, and Matheson.
Yes, very much. That was a little weird. But anyhow, one of the things that I normally do on the Hugo's There podcast is a little bit of allowing my guests to talk about themselves and talk about their nerdy history. Colin has already done this, of course, but right. James, you have not, and I'm springing this on you.
Oh, at the awesome.
Spur of the moment. So I figure there are people who have listened to Take Me to Your Reader for 5 years who have a good impression of, you know, who you are.
Right.
But folks on Hugo's There side who maybe don't cross over don't know much about you. So what is the history of your nerdery?
Well, that's assuming I'm a nerd, which is a fair assumption. So there you go.
I was going to say, we're sitting here in a room with a Deep Space Nine model. Somewhere.
Right. Yep. Model of Deep Space Nine, space stations and Tyrannosaurus Rex action figures, comic book stuff.
Yep.
Lots of sci-fi books.
Yeah. So how did you come up in terms of becoming a science fiction or fantasy fan?
It goes back a long way, I suppose. I've been reading science fiction since I was a kid and playing video games and watching science fiction movies, enjoying things like Terminator and Total Recall back in the day.
Nice.
Back when they first released.
Yes. Some of them anyway, right?
Right.
Because you're like 8 years younger than I am and like 10 years younger than Colin. So cool.
Okay. So I was around when Terminator 2 initially released. How about that?
Yes. I will believe that one.
Yeah.
Were you more of a... Like, did you start off as more of a book fan or more of a movie fan, or is it just kind of all combined?
Probably movies, with like Star Wars and stuff like that.
Okay.
But I also read, you know, Crichton back in the day too, so.
Nice. Yeah. So what did you, did you take books with you when you were underway in the Navy?
I did. I also took books with me on road trips. I'm one of those weird individuals that can actually read books while they're being driven around.
Okay, but not while driving.
No, not while driving.
Yeah, no, I've never been accused of getting car sick either, so.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, that'll wrap it up for the meet James Ralston portion. Yeah. In case anybody doesn't know, I met James through work. So that's kind of how the connection formed.
Yeah. I met James through Seth.
Right.
Right.
Yes, through us running together.
Yes.
Okay. So under discussion today, we have Conjure Wife by Fritz Lieber, which is a 1943 novel published in Unknown Worlds and then later expanded into a 1952 version of the novel.
Slightly longer.
Slightly longer, yeah. We don't really know how much longer, but it's slightly different as well. It's reorganized a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have three movies. We have 1944's Weird Woman, starring Lon Chaney. And then we have the 1962 film Burn, Witch, Burn, which was the American title of it. The English title was Night of the Eagle. And then we have the 1980 movie starring Terry Garr and Richard Benjamin called Witch's Brew, which is where the intro music came from.
Right.
Subtitled, Which is Which?
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, no way.
Really?
I didn't know. Okay. We will talk about these things one at a time, of course. But as always, we start with the story, which is the common thread that weaves through all the media that we're discussing.
Right.
And sometimes that common thread is like 30,000 foot view. Here, I feel like we're closer to the ground where the common thread is pretty common. It's just the execution of it is somewhat different.
Right.
Yeah. I think here you could say there's a central idea. And then if you look at amount of story that you see in various places, it varies.
Yeah, the specifics of the plot are somewhat different, but the premise is the same, right? It's this successful college professor finds out that his wife has been doing conjure magic, and ostensibly to help him in his career,
right?
Which he doesn't believe and rejects. And
also protect him.
Right, and also protect him. And he makes her...
Women's intuition. She senses these things.
Right. So he makes her stop it, and then bad things start to happen to him.
Yes.
And all the details of from there, you know, do diverge somewhat. So, but yeah, the premise is exactly the same. It's just a matter of the execution of it. So, we'll talk about each one of them in turn.
Yeah.
None of us had ever read any Fritz Lieber before?
No.
Don't believe so.
No.
What else has he done?
He's got at least one other Hugo winner.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. The Wanderer.
Yeah. And I'm going to mispronounce it. It's Fawford and the Grey Mouser.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the big fantasy epic.
Mm.
That's Fritz Lieber.
Okay.
Hmm. Yeah.
Which is actually based on him and a friend of his.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, you haven't read it? You just are familiar with it?
I've heard of it.
Okay.
I mean, if, you know, I'm in the biz. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. When I was looking through the library catalog for this book just to see if they had it, which they didn't, I did come across that one, actually, and a bunch of other. It seemed like he's pretty prolific for fantasy, not so much science fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, much more on the fantasy side. I think The Wanderer might be science fiction. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. Yeah, and none of us had any experience with any of these movies, I don't think.
I don't
know.
If I have seen the 1980 movie one, because it looks like an ABC Sunday night special,
it does.
I have no recollection of it.
Yes. So why don't we start talking about the 1943 novel? Now, this is one of the interesting things. What version of this did we read? So, James, what did you read?
I read the version, the Nook version, and I skimmed through that online novella, I guess you could say.
Okay. And Colin?
I read the novel, and I read most of the novella, but never finished it.
Okay. Wow. This is like the one time that I did more homework than anybody. Nice. Because I read the whole novel. I actually got it from Google Play Books, because I didn't pick it up when it was cheap on the Nook Store. And it was so it ended up being cheaper from Google Play than the Nook Store after the price went back up.
Oh, I'm sure.
And then once you mentioned that, well, I mean, I already knew that it was expanded somewhat, but I didn't know to what extent. And so I thought, okay, I'll read it. I've got time because I'd already finished it. So I actually did read the entire novella as well.
Hmm. Okay. Oh,
okay. I kind of like read the first 5 or 10 pages and then the last 5 or 10 pages.
Oh, okay. It's substantially the same.
Yeah. It seemed like it minus the beginning and the end. Because we didn't start out with the intro on the novella was...
Yeah, it was different.
Yeah, with the ladies talking or something like that.
Yeah. So, of course, as always, we go full spoilers on this kind of thing. Usually on the Hugo Is There podcast, we have a non-spoiler discussion first, but I don't really want to do that because we've got 4 things to cover.
Right.
5 if you count the 2 versions of the novel.
Yeah.
So we're going to go full spoilers for this. So that'll be somewhat different.
And I can totally understand why they got rid of the first half of the first part of the novella for this novel, because it's, why would you want to listen to women talking?
All right, so this is going to be a topic.
There'll be a thread of this going through all of our discussions, and that is that it's the 40s, and really, really strong 1940-era gender roles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the movie starts off with the husband demanding that the wife stop her neurotic, psychotic nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Not the original novel. The 1952 one starts with him just apparently out of nowhere going through his wife's stuff and finding the paraphernalia of witchcraft.
Right.
And whereas in the original one from the magazine, it starts off with a discussion of all the ladies, basically showing, okay, there's some adversaries here. It introduces the adversaries before it even introduces the main characters.
Yeah.
I actually prefer the expanded novel where there's a little more mystery about that, where you don't really find out. You don't get any point of view from the adversary women until a really long later way into the book.
Yeah, much later on, yeah.
Yeah. One of the other premises of the novel and the novella are this: is the basic question is any of this real?
Right.
Is the witchcraft real? Is this just something she believes? Is what's happening an incredible series of coincidences? Mm-hmm. And the opening section of the novella, I think, to me, paints it pretty strongly that the witchcraft is real.
Yes.
And I think maybe that's just because they believe it strongly. Mm-hmm. And I had read the novella after the novel, so I had the benefit of knowing, oh, so they are going to work together and do all these things together against Tansy. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, whereas in the 1952 one, I feel like it is a little more skeptical. And at the end, you kind of come around to, yeah, I'm not sure, right?
Right.
At by the end of it, Norman hasn't gone, yeah, that was all real, all of it, totally. He's still somewhat skeptical of it. But I think he, I don't know.
I think he's at least on the path because, quick overview of the novel, okay? So there's Norman and Tansy, sailor, and they're at a university. She's protecting him through witchcraft. He finds witchcraft, all the her charms and hexes. They're all protective. They're not attack or evil. They're like white. And he forces her to stop it. And then the instant he burns the last item of protection, lots of bad things starts happening. He gets a call from a student who claims that she's his unrequited lover. Another student calls and says, well, you were forcing me out. Right. He doesn't get the job at the university. He cuts himself shaving. He starts having fantasies about throwing himself in front of a truck, which has been a long-term fear of his.
Right.
Tansy kind of intervenes and takes this big curse onto herself. Mm-hmm. And she goes and throws herself into the ocean and almost completely drowns herself before Norman rescues her.
Right.
And Norman rescues her through practicing of magic.
Right.
And there's a very explicit description of what he does and the resistance he feels doing it. It's very sensual in that you know, he hears it and smells it and feels it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's not in time to save her. She's lost her soul.
Right.
And so then the rest of the book is her trying to get her soul back and Norman struggling with whether or not still, if this is really real.
Right. Or if he's just humoring her and she's a nutter.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And then left open are the questions of, you know, well, it's an incredible series of coincidences.
Right.
And but one example is how does she find him after she throws herself into the sea in New Jersey?
Right.
Right. And then later on, he's determined to apply classic male logic to this. And so he takes a series of equations, symbolic equations, which represent magic. And he takes it to his friend who is the husband of one of the other wives who is a witch.
That was actually pretty funny.
And says, you know, help me figure this out. And it's the spell for how to return Tansy's soul to her body.
Right.
Which works. And so I think the practice of the magic says that he might not be fully bought into it, but he's on the path and walking.
Yeah. So one thing I would say, and James, I would welcome your comment on this as well. Okay. We've talked about this from an adaptational consideration. I feel like there's enough skepticism represented in the book that you could take it either way in a movie, and I would be fine with it. You could basically say, okay, I'm answering the question of if it was real, and I'm going to say no. Or I'm answering the question, if it was real, I'm going to say yes, or you could stick with the maybe.
Yeah, because I think the book doesn't do that. It still leaves it open for you to interpret.
But like Colin was saying, and I do agree, the novel really does seem to indicate that he did magic, or at least...
Yeah, but he's still like denying it to himself in the end. Anyway. Yeah. He doesn't fully believe it. I think it kind of illustrates the power of that denial in the first place.
Yeah.
He's just doing what he thinks might help her, whether or not he believes it or not.
Mm.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I think she finds her way back to the hotel in Jersey through his guiding spirit. Because his spirit that he summoned doing his magic is the one that saved her.
But to go back to your point about doubt, if there is no magic.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The guiding spirit is.
Yeah. True.
Yes. Zombie GPS.
Right.
Yeah. Let's talk about the gender roles, though. I feel like because we were just interviewing your wife downstairs,
right.
And to where she's like, "Nope, I hate all of it. Everything's D's and F's," because just the, you know, this is a story about a man who won't listen to his wife, and his wife is totally right. And even in the novel, the biggest flaw in terms of like the gender roles and everything, it's a novel about a guy who won't listen to his wife. His wife is completely right, and he still gets to rescue her. And I'm like, oh, come on.
No. Well, he gets the opportunity to, but he causes all this to happen.
Yeah, he causes it all to happen, but still he gets the hero moment at the end to help her get her soul back. So I feel like it leans really hard into the, well, I mean, anything good that's going to happen really does end up coming from the man, even though the bad stuff also came from him.
Yeah. I see your point, but to me it was more like, I need to fix what I broke.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. And that's a responsible thing to do, but it's not the kind of thing to go, wow, what a hero. Good guy. You know, it's like that old Chris Rock bit about, you know, applauding men for like not leaving their wives and bringing up their kids. He's like, that's what you're supposed to do. You know, we shouldn't be like, wow, that's amazing. No, that's what you're supposed to do.
The other thread that kind of runs through there, which is an element of doubt, is that not only does he find her doing this kind of stuff, the witchcraft, mm-hmm. but then there's this long going thread where he's afraid to share things with her because he doesn't want to reactivate her neurosis.
Right.
So not only is she doing something wrong, but right. she isn't as strong as I am or as healthy as I am. And so I have to protect her
yeah.
from these things. Mm-hmm. And that's also a thread that runs through the book and a couple of the movies mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, it's not only a guy not listening to his wife, he's also not communicating with her to give her the information that she would need to go, okay, look, I told you bad stuff was going to happen.
Yeah. Right.
And you do have that in one of the movies where it's kind of voiceover thing in the back where he's hearing her say, I can't be responsible for what happens. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about those in turn. So just in terms of the gender roles, okay, I'm just from page 22 of the 1952 novel, okay? If he had ever wondered about Tansy and superstitions at all, it had only been to decide, with a touch of self-congratulation, that for a woman, she was almost oddly free from irrationality. Okay.
I think that inspired Jack Nicholson's line in...
As good as it gets.
As good as it gets.
Yes. Well, how do you write women so well? I think of a man, and I take away reason and accountability. Yes, it probably did. But... there's no question that character is sexist.
Yes, so, without a doubt.
Yeah. We haven't really talked about did we enjoy the novel.
I felt it was kind of slow.
It is a little slow.
And maybe that's because it's not really an action novel. It's more of a creeping horror where you're introduced to this situation and what's going on behind the scenes. You spend a lot of time in Norman's head. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, James?
I like the last half better than the first half.
Why?
More action-packed. There you go.
Okay, so you like it. Like, from what point? From the point she loses her soul?
I think from the point where... So you got the beginning where they kind of go through... Before there's any hint of magic going on, it's pretty humdrum, mm-hmm. like Colin was saying.
Yeah.
Probably, I guess, maybe from the point where he makes her burn... Or I guess he burns all the stuff.
Right.
Where they burn all the stuff and then things start happening. But I think there could have been any elimination of even space in there. It just seems sure. like a lot of filler mm-hmm. up until the point where she takes the curse from him and then absconds. And that part was interesting, going yeah. through all of that.
Okay.
And then retrieving her soul after that. I liked the twist at the end. Mm-hmm. It was neat.
Yeah.
That was good.
So I haven't gotten to talk to you much about this one. Colin and I have chatted a little bit mm-hmm. During the week.
Yeah.
Or, when
I went back and read that part twice just to make sure I was thinking about it right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was twisty. I like it.
Yeah.
I honestly thought a great place to end that novel would have been with Tansy showing up at the front door.
Oh, really?
Because then you're completely in limbo.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Well, and it's the Twilight Zone ending, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple parts in this that I really enjoy. And one of my favorites was when, I don't even remember how it happened. I think the bull roarer, that's what it was called.
Yeah.
That wow thing that Crocodile Dundee does in Crocodile Dundee 2.
Wow, wow, wow.
Over his... lecture.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Gets into his head and he goes to class and starts lecturing and goes completely out of his head and starts ranting about how men and women should be having sex before marriage and stuff. and just kind of goes into a trance the whole time, you know, encouraging premarital relations, mm-hmm. Which is scandalous in, you know, the 40s, I'm sure.
Definitely.
So, yeah, I enjoyed that. One of the things that kept coming up in the novel was the, you know, about 2 weeks. 2 weeks more.
Right.
Because he has this fear of trucks, lorries, if you're
lorries,
in England, right? And at some point, he's sort of walking out. He's got the impulse to walk out in front of a truck. But then that thing comes into his subconscious. No, no, no. You know, 2 weeks from now, then we'll do that. Yeah. And that's what Tansy kind of gloms onto that and says, oh, I got to take this curse away from him before the clock strikes zero. And then he has a very short amount of time to rescue her.
Right, because it's going to make her do this in 2 days. Mm-hmm. One thing we should point out is when Tansy does this little bit of magic on him, she does several smaller episodes of magic, even mm-hmm. after she gives up mm-hmm. all of her protective yeah. charms.
Right.
Tying
and things like that.
Yeah, the knot tying, and which I think is cool. Seth's favorite part of the entire book and maybe all the movies, mm-hmm. because one of the other wives enchants a stone dragon from the side of the building mm-hmm. to go and attack them. And it yeah. kills their cat.
Yes.
Right. I remember writing that and saying, cat died. Seth is going to love this.
Yep. That's why Seth likes the book.
But then it starts approaching the house and Tansy begins tying a series of knots. Well, knot work is an old charm. Mm-hmm. And she summons down 7 strands of lightning and just blows the thing up. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it's there in their yard.
Right.
And everyone knows it's there. It's in the papers the next day. And it's kind of covered up.
Right.
As a
prank.
As a prank, prank. Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's what I wish they had done in the movie when we get there, I guess. That would have been cool. But I guess it does kind of, I guess it jives with the end of the movie, though, where like there wasn't really any damage to the door or his jacket or.
You're talking the 62 movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Yes, probably the only one really worth talking about, but we'll get there.
Well. I did write down, you know, grim cat death. Yeah. So, I mean, that was pretty horrifying though. I mean, it just smashed its head, right?
Oh yeah.
And I mean, when you're a stone dragon, you can do that.
Yeah. So the other sympathetic magic she does is she takes the curse off Norman onto herself.
Right.
And when that happens, things change. Instead of having 2 weeks, she's got 2 days mm-hmm. and she begins leaving Norman a set of notes.
Right.
And the notes.
But she's being pursued. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or driven.
Right.
Or, you know, she says, I can only write.
Well, I thought it was watched. She was being watched.
Yeah. Yeah. When, you know, and then she realizes she can get drunk and then when she's relaxed, she can write more, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. she begins to leave him, this spell mm-hmm. and he has to collect all these components and do all these things. And he gets the note kind of trickles out as he's following her to New Jersey, where she had a childhood fear of throwing herself in the ocean and drowning.
Right.
Right.
Taking a long walk off a short pier.
Yes.
Yeah. So then he's able to use that formula to bring her back to him. But mm-hmm. then there's the big dun-dun-dun moment where she comes back to the door and says, you were too late. You were 1 minute too late.
Yeah. Right.
And then there's a protracted scene or series of events that have her soulless, but she's still animate, right? Mm-hmm. So she can still speak, but it's not her, right? And she just keeps saying, I want my soul.
Right.
And this is where she reveals that all women everywhere are witches.
Right.
Yeah. They call into the room
a cleaning lady.
Yeah. And Norman's hiding in the closet. And Tansy begins to ask her a series of questions. And finally, she asks her, do you know the way of getting things? And some other catchphrase. Mm-hmm. And she goes, well,
We're not supposed to talk about it. Yeah.
Yep. And so if you can just call somebody off the street, literally off the street in the middle of the night and say, oh yeah, I do that.
Hey, did you see in the magazine version, like one of the taglines for the book was, you know, the mystery of women, what do they keep in those handbags?
Oh yeah, yeah.
I like, there's the notion that he who walks behind, right? So it's this spiritual force.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's driving her at that point. But. Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you, James, where like the novel is pretty slow in places, but that kind of latter half of it is compelling.
Right, right.
And drives forward.
Now that you mentioned going from the 2 weeks to the 2 days, that might also have served to make it more fast-paced and compelling because he only has 2 days to find it, and then all of a sudden she's without her soul. And there was some mention in there where the soul can't last too long without the body and vice versa. So they were under pressure to get this done as soon as possible before the soul was no longer available.
Yeah,
type of thing.
Yeah, and you have some misdirection in there where there's the body swap switcheroo that goes on, mm-hmm. where Evelyn Sawtell has the soul at some point,
right?
And Norman sees her smile at him strangely,
right.
and realizes later it's because Tansy was in there on a ride along, and then whatever her name was, Mrs. Carr.
Right.
Ends up hijacking it.
Yep.
Because she wants to swap bodies with Tansy because Tansy's young and beautiful.
Exactly. Right. And Mrs. Carr's not.
Right. And I like, you know, there's the part where she's like, you know, Mrs. Carr's much older than you think. You know, she's closer to 100 than to 80. And she's going to come here. I know she's going to come here. You have to be ready. You have to shoot her. And, you know, it's the typical, like, body double kind of thing. You know, not me, idiot, shoot her, you know. And,
Yeah.
And where he recognizes a gesture from her, the way she shakes her head, and recognizes that she's actually on board in Mrs. Carr's body, and mm-hmm. so it all comes out okay.
And bada bing, bada boom.
Yep. Yeah. And then, you know, fake Tansy in Evelyn or in Mrs. Carr's body mm-hmm. draws the other witches together so they can perform the spell, which swaps them back.
Right.
It doesn't swap them back. Mrs. Carr never gets her soul back. I don't believe she gets her soul back because they talk about how her will her husband even notice.
Yeah.
That's the way the book ends.
Right. She doesn't get her soul back. They just put hers back in there, and well, I don't know what happens to it, I guess.
I don't know either. I mean, you could be right, but my read on the implication of the last little, like last right. paragraph of the book is that, you know, Will, what was it? Harvey? Is that his name?
No, that's Harvey Sawtelle.
Oh, that's right. So whatever her husband's name is.
Yeah. Will he ever notice?
Yeah, will he even notice?
Because he was like the one that was like super boring and
yeah.
all this other stuff.
So the other part, and you referenced it, Colin, the boiling down magic to its fundamental principles.
Right.
By comparing similar conjures from different cultures and putting them into mathematic symbols.
Right.
And then having one of the other professors simplify the equations down.
Yeah, it's Mrs. Carr's wife, a husband.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Now that would be a very modern take on it.
Yes.
Mrs. Carr's wife. but of course that's applying like, you know, male rationality to magic to improve it, right? And I'm like, oh, okay, that's another problematic thing.
Yeah.
Another problematic thing is, of course, the way the cultures are referred to that the superstitions come from. There's very consistent right. use of the word Negro, which was it a polite term? In the 40s, I don't know. It's not the kind of thing anybody our age ever said, right?
Right.
So I see that word. And I'm like, yeah. That's, yeah. Are we allowed to say that? I don't think so.
Yeah, they all come from uncivilized cultures.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Primitives.
Primitive cultures.
Primitives.
Yeah.
Superstitious.
Anyhow, I mean, I thought it was a pretty enjoyable read, other than the fact that it's extremely sexist.
Yeah.
So probably if you're a dude, you could read this one and kind of chuckle at it a little bit. And if your wife reads it, she'll probably just be burning the entire time.
Burn, book burn.
Yes. Yes. All right. So shall we talk about some of the movies?
Sure.
Let's talk about the first one, the earliest one.
You want to go in order?
Yes.
Okay. So this is the 1944 one with Lon Chaney.
Yeah, right.
Weird woman.
Weird woman.
She was kind of weird, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, weird is an old... It has a connotation with witchcraft, right?
Yeah.
The weird sisters from Harry Potter.
Yep, yeah.
Anybody who marries a professor that old, you just got to ask yourself, right?
Yep.
Why?
Yeah, that was a little yeah. that was a
James
little weird.
Texted the other day and said, I watched The Weird Woman and the movie. this one has a 6.4 on IMDb, so pretty well regarded. You know,
yeah, I thought it was actually going to be better than it was because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a very brief movie. It's barely over an hour.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this was one I got from the library, right? Mm-hmm. And where it had the, what was the?
It was part of like
Inner Sanctum set. Mysteries or
yeah,
something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is kind of like a night gallery or something where each one, I think, was introduced by this head in a jar.
yes.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the only thing that our library had related to this at all.
You know, that's a little surprising because this novel has been printed. There have been 12 printings of it continuously since its original publication.
We should fill out a purchase request.
Yeah, we should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, especially since it just got the Retro Hugo.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Like that article that you sent us. Do you remember that?
Which with all the different covers
the
and
the publication history?
Right.
Yes. Yeah, that was fascinating. Yeah. I'll put that in the show notes.
That was neat. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a history of the way the covers kind of revealed the biases of the publishers at the time, what they wanted to put forward, you know, the damsel in distress, or is it the wicked woman kind of thing where it looks like a very Stephen King kind of cover?
Right.
Yeah.
Anyhow, 1944.
1944.
This is the first case we have where most of the names are different.
Yes.
I think Norman is still Norman, right? But everybody else.
He was still Norman, but his last name was different. And then pretty much everybody else. There was still an Evelyn in there and a Sawtelle, but.
Yeah, but there's no Tansy. It's Paula. No,
right. Bunch of names got changed.
Yeah. Ilona instead of Flora, I think.
Well, the question, you know, who is Ilona?
Yeah.
So this movie takes a really interesting tack. And it takes the, this is all BS tack to the witchcraft.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, it's all ridiculous. What was it? Delicious feminine logic from The Fly, right?
Yeah,
that's what Emily kept referencing.
Yep.
Yeah. In fact, all the witchcraft is merely Ilona behind the scenes, socially poisoning people against Norman and Paula.
Right. Right. Because she's jealous that she was pining for Norman for a long time. Then he goes off to the pagan islands and meets this pretty little thing.
Looks like he went to Hawaii.
Yeah, sort of. Well, yeah, that's 1944 movie, right? Are you going to do your job and make a diverse cast there, or are most of your natives going to be white people with some makeup
pretty much.
With dark tans?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's told in flashback, right? It shows a flashback of that. Mm-hmm. The movie is full to the rim with voiceover that drives me absolutely crazy. I mean, voiceover can be good. It can be done well, and it can be done not well.
Well, it wasn't narrative voiceover. It was I'm thinking voiceover.
It was interior monologue, which is great in a book and not great in a movie. You, like, you have him talk to somebody. Have him actually speak to someone.
Right.
But he can't.
But then he would have been communicating with his wife.
Yeah. No, no. He definitely wouldn't have been. He
or
would
another definitely. Woman for that matter. You can't do that.
Yeah. So if you have these doubts about your wife's sanity and what she's doing, you can't talk to someone about that.
I don't know. You could talk to a shrink. Doctor-patient confidentiality. You know, maybe. I don't know.
But then you're talking to a shrink and...
A shrink talking to a shrink.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just saying, I think there's a way to access that interior monologue better than voiceover. So...
Not when you have a cast of like five people.
Well, that is true, right? This is a small production. Lon Chaney's the main dude. Mm-hmm. He has this much hotter wife who's much younger than him.
Much younger. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Jeez Louise.
So you can kind of understand why people would be like, oh, that's a little skeezy.
Yeah. Just a little bit. Alona seemed much more appropriate.
And like Colin said, right? This is the skeptic's version of this story.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Not really a witch's version of it.
Mm-hmm. Although a bunch of the stuff still holds true.
Yeah.
So, the instant he burns all of her stuff, you know, he gets the unrequited love from the student and the other student accusing him. Although I think that's where the entanglement between Jenkins and the young girl comes from.
Yeah.
And that carries through a couple of the other movies.
Right. Yeah. That's one of the things I always find interesting about a book with multiple adaptations, where you end up with some stuff that clearly they're like, we're going to go closer to the source, but then they also pull in some things from the movie that they're remaking. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's a half readaptation, half remake, mm-hmm. where you'll see threads that
it always seems pull weird. Through.
I don't know. Yeah. I kind of like it though. I like in a remake movie, I do like some nods back to whatever the original was, even if it was, you know, less than faithful. Like in The Thing, I just wanted one reference to The Thing being a carrot, you know, a vegetable. No, I didn't. That was a case that we didn't need that nod, and I'm glad we didn't get it.
No.
Colin and I were talking about, you know, the kind of the essentials of adaptation for this. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Colin really wanted to see was burning all the stuff, but there being one thing held back, and that when that thing was destroyed, then everything was set off. And this movie does have that. So that's like one of the little bits of canonicity that it has.
The 1944 movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I think they all have that.
Yeah, they all have it to some extent.
Yeah.
But in the book, it's something Norman does without Tansy's knowledge.
Right.
Like she knows she held something back and then finds out that he destroyed it, where in some of the movies, she's right there when he does it.
Yeah.
So there's the point in the story where the disgruntled student who is getting bad grades threatens him with a gun.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And in this movie, ends up basically shooting himself.
Because they struggle.
Yeah, they struggle.
Right.
And there's just the, like, I mean, did they not have justifiable homicide in 1944? <'Cause>, like, dude attacked you with a gun, and if he ends up dead,
right.
I don't think that you go up for murder.
Mm. But it still looks bad.
One, it still looks bad. And two, he's lost his protections, and so he no longer has the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
His incredible luck. Right. You're from the 1980 movie, right? Mm-hmm. He's a habitual speeder.
Right.
And the instant she loses all those charms, he drives off and gets a ticket.
We'll get there.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did we think of this movie?
1944?
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was terrible. I will say, just across the board, I enjoyed all three movies. That doesn't mean I think they were all good. I don't think the 1944 one was very good.
Yeah, no.
But for its time, you know, it was fine.
I wasn't a fan of Lon Chaney, I suppose. Mm. And the voiceovers. The voiceovers and his overacting was a bit much.
Yeah.
Okay. It's 1944. All they had was overacting.
Right. Well, that's the interesting thing, too, to look at the differences in the dramatic sensibility from 1944 to 1962, because I feel like each one of these is very much a product of their time.
Sure.
And so in 1944, the overacting, you have this quality scream and faint when there's the death chant, which just sounds like Polynesian singing, you know?
Yes.
Exactly.
Doesn't even sound vaguely creepy. It doesn't sound like I would think a death chant would sound, but.
No, they're at a luau.
Yeah.
They're death chanting the pig before they eat it.
Pig. Pork. Anything else we want to talk about this one, or should we move on?
I think we should move on to something better.
Okay. All right. Well, we do move on to something better, at least putting my cards on the table here.
Yep.
The 1962 movie Burn Witch Burn, alternate title Night of the Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
This one, 79% tomato meter, 65% audience actually was better liked by the critics than audiences, and 6.9 on IMDb, so better regarded than...
And 4.5 stars on Amazon.
Oh, was it?
Yep.
Yeah. I really like this movie.
But yeah.
I mean, as an adaptation, I liked it quite a bit, though I watched all the movies before I read the book. So nice. Like, I know what I think of them as movies outside of the adaptational considerations.
Fair enough. Fair
it right. makes me worry about Seth James. It does. He's out there watching movie after movie.
He does this backwards quite often.
He does. Trying to wonder, you know, what's truth in life? Is this what the book is going to be like? Or maybe it's this one. Or maybe it's neither one of them at all.
Yep.
He's ruining our single source of truth.
No, it kind of makes it fun to... I mean, it's the opposite of what you do during a movie where... What tends to happen, right, with general people, they read a book and then they come into the movie with a checklist of things that they want to see in the movie, right? And we do it.
By people, you mean me.
We'll like go fist bump in a movie when something happens that we're like, yes. That should have been in here. But I'm doing the opposite. I'm looking for the stuff that happened in the movies. I'm looking for any seed of them in the book. And it makes it kind of fun. Mm.
Yeah.
So you're really trying to redeem a movie rather than tear it down.
Mm-hmm. So... one little bit of trivia about this. Peter Cushing was originally going to be the star of this movie.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah. That would have been cool.
Yeah.
But the schedule didn't work out. So they ended up with the other guy, and I don't know his name.
Huh.
This one is written by Richard Matheson, co-written by Richard Matheson, George Baxt, and Charles Beaumont. And I know I've heard Charles Beaumont's name quite a bit, but Richard Matheson, obviously. Yeah. Right, he wrote a lot of Twilight Zone. And it has kind of some of that feel to it.
Yeah. Well, also, I Am Legend and a whole host of other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, obviously.
We've got a chunk in our database of like, you know, 15 or 20 lines of things that he's written that's been adapted.
Yep.
I thought we had that many. I didn't realize it was that many.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a number of novels as well as all the Twilight Zone stuff.
Mm-hmm. So. Right.
And short stories.
Good point.
Lots of short stories.
Yeah. Well, he did the Robot Rocky one, right?
Yeah, oh, right. Real Steel.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So the 1962 movie... highly canonical.
Yeah.
I mean, point after point, I was like, wow, this is coming from here. This is coming from here.
For the first 75% or so.
Yeah. And then, so it's really only.
Then I got disappointed.
Yeah. Tansy against Mrs. Carr.
Yeah. At least it was Tansy though.
Yeah. Although it did bring in a nice scene about the Stone Eagle. And given the technology of the time, they did it a really good job. Mm-hmm. I mean, today, it would be done with CGI. Cool. And what they ended up doing, they had an eagle on a string.
Right.
Right.
Not a tow rope, maybe a keeping line or something.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Just it doesn't fly to or and get into the scaffolding.
Yeah.
Or whatever, probably.
And it's big. It's statue size. So not a little tiny eagle. And so to give you that sense of perspective, they use a bunch of camera tricks. And then did you notice that when they were in the building, James, that he ran down a hallway and then there was this giant eagle shadow.
I'm
like, oh, that is perfect. Yeah. Very well done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's one thing. I feel like this movie is just technically much better than the 1944 one. And it could be just partly of the time.
I thought it was shot well.
Yeah.
Directed well, like you were saying.
Yeah.
And I actually liked the actors this time around.
Mm-hmm.
Might have been the British accent. I don't know. Right. They sounded more intelligent.
It does make them more classy.
Yes. A little more classy.
Yeah. Yeah, although I think there was some classism happening here too.
How's that?
Well, Jennings, the student who never does his homework.
He's Irish.
Right.
Well, I thought he was American.
Oh, no. Well, I think he was trying to do American, but he's definitely Irish.
So okay.
Not English. Yes.
Yeah, so there was the English people and the not English people, but Tansy also has an American accent.
Yes.
And so the people who have dubious beliefs maybe aren't fully trustworthy.
Right.
They're not English.
Although Flora Carr had an accent. So that's, she was female. English. So. It was either English or like the mid-Atlantic accent.
Yeah.
You know, the classic kind of 1940s cinema accent.
Cinema.
Like Charles Emerson Winchester.
Yes. He has an affectation.
Yeah. There's several times in here where I'm like, oh, I really like what they did with the directorial choices. I really liked in the kind of car pursuit. I liked that POV thing. It made it look like he was driving just, you know, hellbent, you know, balls to the wall. I really liked, what they did with the eagle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you would have rather seen a dragon. But if they did a dragon, it would be in like Harryhausen and that could have been nasty.
Yeah.
So this way they're like, you know what? If we do an eagle.
Yeah. I don't know if they could have got a dragon on a tow rope.
Yeah. I don't, they are.
Their union is so strong.
Catch a dragon by the tail. Yeah, exactly.
Then we'd have to learn how to train your dragon.
But yeah, yeah, I was surprised how well they, I was surprised what a good job they did with the special effects for the eagle, other than that first shot of it swooping down where you can see the ropes.
Yes.
Right.
Well, and with the light, I don't see how you could miss it. Because it's going to be back underlit. It's right where the camera is.
We should go down there and play it in standard definition and see if we can figure it out.
Ooh, that's true. We did watch it in HD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's meant to be watched that
versus the next one movie we're going to talk about. Sheesh.
Yeah. Boy.
But, yeah.
So
don't forget the hairy chest. You can't not say anything about the hairy chest. That's fantastic.
It was. I mean, and
Emily noticed it, but even I was like, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a figure of a man. Well, she was trying to figure out, right? Why does she want to die for this guy? He's a douche.
Right.
and that's part of the problem, right? And I was trying to pin Emily down on this about, do you just, like, she's giving D's and F's to everything. I'm like, is that just because you don't like Norman or because you don't think the movie was good? And she could not get past the sexism underlying everything in the movie.
Right.
And I totally get it. It completely makes sense. You know, I mean, for a woman, she is surprisingly free of irrationality. So the part of this movie that's missing, of course, is you don't really have anything explicitly saying that her soul was stolen.
Right. There is a point where she's controlled via
voodoo.
Voodoo magic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where she tries to Norman Bates him, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And during that time, she's not walking like herself. She's walking like the lady that's controlling her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a nice affectation. You asked me if I noticed it, and I thought, yes. And then I was wondering, well, it was pretty obvious. Is like, does she have like a charm in her shoe or something? Or no. Just she's limping, and that means she's being controlled.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's the. I feel like if you had gone more canonical with the book and done the head shake thing, it's a little harder to get an audience to pick out a head shake than a limp. A limp's a little more in your face.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they only have an hour and a half or 2 hours to have us introduce the physicality of a character that you would recognize. Oh, this is the way this person moves and talks.
And when we get to the 1981, I like the way they handled that in that one. So one of the things you liked was there's that common thread of the something being some kind of sound manipulating Norman, right?
Right.
With the tape. And that's when he's getting chased by the eagle and his house is on fire and
yes. And they substituted theremin for Bull Roar.
Right. Yes. And he ends up in his classroom where he has on the board, I do not believe, with not circled. Right. Yeah. And then they cut back to it after the music stops and he's erased the not, I do believe.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. And that's partially to go with the voiceover from the beginning and the, you know, the end. Do you believe, you know, do you believe? And it's a quality villain death. I like the fact that the eagle fell on Flora.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Because if you weren't going to do all the body swap magic,
you gotta do something.
Then yeah, had to do something. Had to get her, have her get her comeuppance in some way. So yeah, no, I like this one. I thought the acting was good. I thought the writing was good and the directing was good. So I thought it was a good movie.
Yeah. The one thing that, so I'm going to hold this one to a pretty high standard because so many of the movies have been really canonical.
Yeah.
Tansy does not know whether or not what she's doing is real or not.
Right.
And after Norman destroys all of her things, she's really appreciative. Oh, thank you. That's such a huge weight off my shoulders, which kind of feeds into the whole, you know, misogynist narrative that's going
on,
right?
In the book.
In the book.
Yeah.
Right. There is no doubt in any of the movies that the Tansies.
Right.
Or Margaret's or whoever they are, believe that they are committed, that they're doing witchcraft.
Right.
Right. Tansy's kind of doing this. It's almost like a nerve. It's a superstition. Mm-hmm. It's not an act of will. It's a, well, doing this makes me feel better.
Right. Maybe it's not doing anything, but might as well do it anyway.
Right.
Yeah. And part of that, I think, is different in a book. You can kind of have that. You can get in her head and have her think that way. Right. I'm not sure if it was ever doing anything, but. Although that wasn't really in her head. That was in a conversation with her and Norman.
Yeah. Yeah. And it always makes me wonder, is she kowtowing to him? Mm-hmm. Or is she really, 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 truly, you know, thankful this is over? Because as the bad things begin to happen, because she's lost all of her charms, she has no sense of magic anymore.
Right.
So.
You mean in the book, right?
In the book.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Where in this one, in the 62 one, you did have that moment where they're on the phone and the sound is playing over the phone, which I like that, you know, there's a reference to the novel, something happening over the phone, right? The phone's trying to grab them in the novel. You don't ever get that.
Right. But
you get the notion that the phone has to be put off the hook in some way in order to prevent it. But after all that happens, then she is definitely pandering to him and saying, you know, it was just a coincidence that the lights went out, you know.
Definitely.
You're not worried about me now, right?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was pandering or if she was getting back at him, throwing his own words at him.
Oh.
Everything's fine, right? Nothing is all coincidence,
that's
right?
That's what I was thinking.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. In fact, there was one other time that happened in the novel where they mentioned, will her husband even recognize that she's different? I thought it was because she wouldn't practice magic anymore.
Oh, okay.
Not because she hadn't got her soul back.
Mm.
Yeah, that's all interpretation, right? It isn't essential to the plot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think to your point about doubting herself, she kind of expressed that in her introduction to magic, right? When she was talking about how she would have killed herself to save him on the island.
Yes.
Right.
She would sacrifice anything.
But since then,
him.
She's already gained her, confidence and power and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Well, and he's so successful. They have a nice house. Mm. They have an incredible car. They live in England.
Yeah.
At Hempnell.
Well, why don't we move on to the much more groovy.
The groovy version.
Yes, it's groovy, baby. Yeah.
Well, so what's the general take of this movie? It sounds pretty positive from the way people are talking.
Yeah,
but
1962? Like
1962.
Yeah, like it.
I like those 4 stars.
Mm-hmm. So 1980, Witch's Brew, not containing any brews. No potions whatsoever.
Oh, I had some brews.
Well, no. she paints him with that combination of blood and bat guano and pig urine and who I don't remember what else.
Yeah.
Actually, I may have written it down.
So this one, I don't know if you guys, did you do any Googling
bat guano,
about this one?
Cat urine and lamb's blood.
Ram's blood, cat urine, and bat guano.
Lamb's blood.
Lamb's blood. Not ram.
Lamb.
Younger.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I wrote down the first line of my notes here, groove into the title song.
Yes.
It's kind of...
I did like the music in this movie.
Yeah. It was bluesy funk, and they've got a lot of brass and sax.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just really good.
There was definitely some disco in there. And the reason is this movie was shot in 1978.
And yet it wasn't released...
Oh, really?
Until 1980.
1980?
And it never got a theatrical release.
Oh.
So how was it? Was it like straight to VCR or straight to television?
I mean, I wrote down... The first director was fired halfway through filming in 1978, and then there were additional scenes filled in 1979. I think that the Lucifer egg was a separate thing. That's my, if you ask me which part of this movie was filmed at a different time, that's the part I think was different.
It might have got the first guy fired, though. You never know.
That's true. And there was some editing mess, never got a theatrical release, premiered on television and then on home video in 1985.
Oh, Lucifer egg thing did seem kind of...
random.
Yeah. Didn't quite fit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does have a lot of commonalities with the book, right? Colin texted me, holy canonicity, Batman.
where it was thing after thing after thing.
Yeah. I mean, this is case study number one in canonicity. Does not make it a good movie. I enjoyed this one kind of because to me it read like a comedy, but then when I went back and watched it again, I'm like, but it's not funny.
Well, you watched this twice?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
That guy was so obnoxious, though.
Yeah. So this is Terry Garr in her prime, beautiful Terry Garr, and Richard Benjamin, who looks like a slightly better looking Rowan Atkinson.
Slightly.
Yeah. Okay. I'll give you that. And obnoxious as hell.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus.
Oh, but he does it really well.
Yeah.
It's hard to know whether it's just the way he acts or if he's playing the character up well.
Yeah. Because he's like, maybe if you spend a little more time trying to be a wife than a witch.
Yeah, no wonder Emily didn't like that.
Yeah.
Oh, no, she was off the rails for this one.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is funny because, you'd think maybe some of the gender politics stuff would change from 1940 into 1980. But
not a lick.
No, not at all. Nope. So that's why I think this one is absolutely ripe for a remake, because you could make a version of this movie where the man gets his comeuppance for not listening to his wife, and in the end he comes around to saying, maybe gender swapped.
Right.
But like I was saying to Emily, I'm like, men would believe that all women were witches. You could get the male audience to believe that. I don't think you get female.
Yeah, probably not.
Audience to believe it.
They already know.
Men are not complicated. That's just what I'm saying. Names are all different in this one, right? I mean, he's still Norman. No.
I remember.
What
but
is
it's
it?
Not that.
It's Jeff. Joshua.
Joshua.
Yeah.
And Margaret Lightman.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all the names are different. You still do have Mrs. No, you don't have Mrs. Carr. You have Vivian, played by Lana Turner. This is Lana Turner's final movie.
Oh, so sad.
This is not a good way to go out. Yeah.
No. Probably could have killed her.
Could have. Yeah.
So, you know, Seth, I've been thinking about this. So we didn't watch the movies in release order. In fact, we probably, you watched all three movies in some order. Mm-hmm. I watched 44, 80, and then just 62 this mm-hmm. morning.
Yeah.
And I think I understand what makes the 44 and the 62 movie so much better than the 80 movie. Exactly. And you're not going to agree with me on this.
Wait, what? Is the 44 movie better than the 80 movie?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes. It's because but there's music. Voiceover in 44 and 62.
No, you're talking about in 62 when you're talking about the opening voiceover?
Yes, there's okay. 4 minutes of diatribe yeah. in the beginning.
Well, I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, that's just like having an opening crawl, right? So yeah. that kind of voiceover, I'm like, okay, we don't need this, but it doesn't offend me the same way that the right. interior monologue stuff does. But
no, but see, 1980 didn't have any of that. And look what you get.
Yeah.
Look.
True.
True. Are you buying it?
No.
Not
a bit of it. Okay. One of the bits of canonicity in this one that I liked was the whole trying to break down the equations where Vivian has her grandson.
Oh, yeah. Show to the computer.
Do that work on the computer. Yeah.
Yes.
Because it's.
That was a nice nod, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's 1980 or 1978. So computers exist.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Whereas in the novel, the computer was a man.
Right. And he did a pretty good job of it.
Yep. It was a very long list of... So this movie starts off with a lot of showing how successful he is and the fact that he's a mm-hmm. consistent speeder, but the speed gun doesn't work when he tries to go by us.
This movie is a bit more overt about how the magic and charms are working for him.
Yes, with the cutting himself shaving and stuff.
Right, yeah.
Yep.
And but he's also an active participant in this one, which he wasn't in the others. Any three, actually, the book or the movies, right?
Yeah. Well, and this one comes the closest to him at the end going, okay, fine. This stuff's real. Mm. You know, let's use it to make a baby.
What do you want? Right.
A boy, I guess. Like, what do I have to do? Stay here all night? Not all night. And do everything, you know.
You know, that's how his accident starts, right? She wants him to stay out to perform some ritual. And mm-hmm. I think it's the one for his... To get him the
chairmanship.
The chairmanship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's had it at that point.
Right. Goes in and takes a shower.
Right. Yeah.
Although the other interesting thing about this movie, actually, I think there are a couple, is it gender swaps Jennings and the student.
Yes.
So instead of there being a male student that's accusing him of forcing him out of the university and a young woman student that says, you know, I'm in love with you. Mm-hmm. He gets a phone call from a guy saying that he's in love with him.
Oh, right.
And this girl starts trying to assassinate him with a rifle.
She's
and,
a crack shot with that rifle, by the way.
Oh, she can hit squat. Yeah.
That first shot was right in front of his head in the windshield.
Yeah, but when you see, you handled a rifle and shot a rifle, right? That's the way she was shooting it with 4 inches of recoil and 2 inches up, there was no way.
Shooting from the hip.
Well, that's funny because when she went to go aim and all that stuff, I'm like, she's not going to hit shit. And then when it actually starts hitting, I'm like, oh, damn. She's a crack shot after all.
Yeah.
Until you go back and see how she's shooting.
Yeah. So, I mean, we haven't really talked about the whole Me Too angle of this, right? Where in a couple of these movies and in the book, there's an accusation of sexual impropriety. On Norman, the Norman character. And in the 1980 movie, it's accused by a male student that he took advantage of him.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remade this movie now, I feel like you couldn't necessarily have that plot point in it because I don't think anybody's going to make a movie now that shows that he didn't do anything and he was being falsely accused because that would support the narrative that there are a lot of false accusations out there, which has never been shown to be the case.
Right.
There are, of course, false accusations, but generally having the conviction that, well, I'm going to believe the woman who's accusing him is usually the right way to go. And in this movie, it's not because it's magic reasons, right?
Right. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with showing a false accusation as long as if you have to be absolutely sure that it's false. In the 1962 movie, mm-hmm. she accused him of making love to her Saturday night.
Right.
Well, Saturday night, she was with Jennings and he was with his wife. And so it was demonstrated that could not happen.
Yeah. But I'm just saying that even doing that, just the having a false accusation kind of leans in the direction of there are a lot of false accusations. I mean, it would be seen that way. I think that's the way it would be received and people would pan it because of that. I mean, Emily was furious about that. you know, just cut that part out.
He should never have brought in the room in the first place, let alone getting brought in the room. And then he gets left alone with her, halfway alone with her.
Yeah.
And then he touches her and it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So many things wrong with this scene.
Yes. Well, I mean, she's a poor, suffering, irrational woman.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the uncomfortable reality of it. Mm-hmm. Is yeah. And then she goes out of there. You know, I hate you. You know, which is right out of the book.
Yep. So yeah. Okay. I would give you that point. There. Yeah. No need to be. No need to give people ammunition.
Yeah, and that's what it would do. So even with the best of intentions, even showing a false accusation, I think, would be received wrong.
Right.
And so you just shouldn't do it. I mean, you should go into it knowing this is not going to be received well. Just cut that out.
Do something else.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's any number of other things you could do. Like, you could do the ethics angle of the thesis that's really similar to his that got buried.
Sure.
That one is absolutely the right thing.
Did that come out in any of the movies, actually?
It did come into one of them. It came into the 1944 one. But it was different because it was one of the other professors who was going to be found out about that. Because his work was based on somebody's previous work that had not been published.
Right. His wife henpecked him so much, which is something that movie did well. It had the multiple other professors and that were a group, and their wives that were a separate group.
Yeah.
Right.
And one of them was definitely henpecked.
Yeah.
In fact, I think it was Sawtelle, Hervey, the guy who becomes the head.
Harvey, like Barclay.
I would swear that in the book it's Hervey, but
it's
I could be wrong.
It's with an E, but it's probably still Harvey.
Harvey.
Yes. The word Berkeley, like Berkeley, California, there's a, I think it's a famous scientist, might have been a philosopher, but it's pronounced Barclay.
Well, there is actually a Barclay in England.
That's what you're spelled about. Like Berkeley?
No.
Okay.
Spelled like you'd expect it to be spelled.
Yeah, and there's a Barclay in Star Trek, too.
we should get Phil to comment. A name that's spelled H-E-R-V-Y or E-Y.
Yeah.
Are you going to pronounce that Harvey or Hervey? Hervey. It was Harvey in the 1962 film, but it looks like
Hervey. I pronounce it Hervey, and I think of a car.
A small car? German made, perhaps?
Yes.
Perhaps. Made you think of going bananas?
It's not the size of the car, it's how you drive it.
Right.
Right. So what else? Yeah. So it's got the 1980 movie has some really bad special effects.
It does.
I don't know that I can fault the acting a lot. I think the people acted fairly well.
Sure.
Even to the point where Joshua Norman is being a jerk. He's really good. He's believable as a jerk.
Yeah. He portrays the hell out of that. So yeah.
So I think the fault was probably in low production value.
Yeah.
And not a great script.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Is this where I put in the rant about Lucifer is not the devil?
Just if you want. Yeah. Insert that here. Yeah.
There's very little evidence from the actual Bible that Lucifer refers to the devil. I'm just saying. There's lots of theologians out there who will tell you that it did. I don't see it. I've studied the Bible a lot, and that same name, essentially Daystar, is attributed to Jesus in different parts. So,
Daystar?
Daystar, Lucifer.
Particularly Lightbringer.
In
Isaiah, right?
Yeah, Isaiah 28. Was that Isaiah? It's either Isaiah 28 and Ezekiel 14 or Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. Mm-hmm. There's the two famous passages that seem to indicate a fall of a creature of light, right? Mm-hmm. But when the Bible was translated into Latin, it was translated into Latin, and that title, Son of the Morning or, you know, Lightbringer, Lucifer was the kind of name attached to it. It wasn't really a name. But then when it was translated into the King James, they kept that and didn't translate it to what it meant. So then it made it look like a name. And so people are like, oh, that's a thing. Bible nerd rant there. So
multidimensional nerd.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like a religious telephone.
More or less. Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing that can basically happen in translation, right?
Yeah.
Yes. This one is the one that comes closest to having the actual soul. I mean, it has the soul stealing thing, right? The body swap.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although not because Tansy kills herself.
Right.
So in the book, the way the soul swap is explained is she throws herself in the ocean. She's dying. That allows her soul to be taken. Mm-hmm. And then later on, there's a soul hop so that he thinks he's got his wife back, but it's really Mrs. Carr in a younger body.
Right.
Right. Here.
Oh, yeah. He totally knocks boots with Vivian, right?
Oh, yeah, he does.
when she's in his wife's body.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yep.
Margaret is going to drive off a pier and then stops because he does the magic. And then she comes home and she's so happy she takes a shower and she gets him in the shower.
Right.
So it's almost a Vivian Leigh kind of psycho scene, but with magic and soul swapping. And
yes.
Right. And kudos to Terry Garr's acting because she actually seems like a different person.
Yeah. She's standing there kind of looking, and she's like, wow, no wrinkles. And, you know, perky Ooh. Things. Yes. Joshua is very oversexed in this movie. I like at some point he says something like, you know, I know I married you for a reason. And then they both like skip dinner because they'd ordered pizza and it doesn't come. That's one of the things that happens because the magic.
Oh.
And so then they do their first little ritual with the drink where they say, you know, through the lips and over the gums, look out, stomach, here it comes, right? That's the tell later.
Right.
When Vivian doesn't get it. But they take it and they're like, right, yep, go to bed. And then it cuts to them in bed together. And he's like, the other reason. And then, of course, the phone starts ringing. And like,
yeah,
I've never answered the phone in that situation. The phone can ring.
It's not that important.
It's not that important.
Try being on call, though. But he, as a professor, he wouldn't be on call, right?
No.
No way. I wouldn't think so.
Finish the sexy times. Then you can return calls. At the end of this one, I kind of liked the little fake out. You think maybe Joshua died of that head wound?
Hoped.
Yeah. Yes. I would kind of have liked to have seen this one get the Twilight Zone ending, where you think everything has come out okay, and then you find out right before the credits roll that Vivian actually won, and she's in Terry's body.
Like she opens up a mirror, and you see Vivian's face instead of Margaret's.
Yeah, that would have been sweet. So
that would have been canon, though.
It wouldn't have been, but I don't know. I feel like that's an acceptable adaptational choice when you already have two adaptations of the book.
But if you go back to the central premise of the story, it's, is this witchcraft real or not?
Right.
And in the 1980s movie, because of the special effects, I don't think there's any doubt that it's real.
Right.
It's portrayed as real from the get-go, and you know he's participating in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's more about the foolishness of not trusting his wife versus, you know, is magic real? And I think that's the wrong take on this story.
Yeah, and of course, you know, like the book, he kind of gets the hero moment where he rescues her using her instructions, and it's very similar to what was in the book, where he has to get the flannel and the grave dirt and the platinum tip of a pen and the record
at the store.
Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah.
And the record needle that's only played a particular thing. By the way, did you ever listen to Scriabin's Ninth Sonata? Mm-mm. It is hot garbage.
Is it really?
It's just, it sounds like a cat that got loose on the top of a piano. It's very modern.
So now I'm going to find it.
Yeah. I'll put it in the show notes. I listened to it while I was reading the book. I found it on YouTube and turned it on while I was reading that part. And I'm like, dang, this is nasty music. But
so do you ever wonder what today's form of magic would look like? The form of magic they have back then.
Freaky Friday.
Maybe Freaky Friday. But, you know, so we don't use pens and we don't use record players.
Mm. Right.
And who's got just flannel in their house for generic reasons? Because people don't sew or make their own clothing or house decorations.
Do. Emily does. Elaine does.
Yeah.
Kathy does too.
Although that's what I thought was interesting. Okay, so that was one interesting part I found in the 1980 movie was because I think in the book and also in one of the other movies, they do a lot of drawing. But in the 80s movie, she's using the Polaroid to take the picture of the egg and then drawing the runes on that white portion of the Polaroid.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was actually kind of neat. It's kind of a modern take on some of the stuff that they did in the book. And
with moving the dragon.
Yeah.
Using the photograph. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of cool, actually.
Yeah. So you were saying what would be in that pouch of things? What would you make it out of?
Yeah, would you have like a thumb drive and some RAM chips and solder sucker?
Right. Take an iPhone case that's only been used, you know, to play Pharrell. You know?
Yes, but only one with rhinestones on it. You need a rhinestone iPhone case. And that's to blind your enemies.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Maybe some single source espresso beans.
Mm. that's a Portland hipster thing. Yeah,
that's the hipster version.
Hipster witching.
Right? Yes. The 1981 is a very interesting thing. And so we mentioned earlier that the only thing we could find at our library was the Inner Sanctum Mysteries that had Weird Woman in it.
Right.
Among, you know, five other movies or four other movies, something like that.
Right.
Where Burn Witch Burn is available on Amazon Prime if you have that.
Right.
And I recommend watching that one. Witch's Brew I could not find anywhere since it got only, you know, went straight to television and home video. There's probably VHS out there somewhere that you can get. I don't know if you can even find a DVD of it, right. But it is on YouTube. And I don't know if it's cool to watch it that way, but I'm just saying that's how I watched it.
It's, well, if you watch it, you'll get your own punishment, because not only is it not a great movie, but the quality of the recording is really low.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like a TV movie, right? Yeah. So it's all 3x4x3 or whatever, and yeah, not great.
In 480, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe only like 469.
Right.
A little shy of 480.
Well, anything else we want to talk about?
No, suppose not.
We should probably rank them.
Probably should. All right. How do we do this? We usually go Colin first, right?
Okay. So from what I liked best to worst.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Book, 62. 80?
Yeah, I know. It was a tough time.
44.
Okay. You okay?
Yeah, well, I was trying to decide, right? So for me, the big essence is this mystery of, you know, is what going on real,
mm-hmm.
right? And in 44, it's absolutely not. And right. in 80, it absolutely is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, right. I think this story is made by the not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And right. So
the fact that the 1944 one answers the question in the negative is what puts it on the bottom for you.
Yeah.
All right. Hmm. You look like you pulled a muscle trying to figure that one out.
Oh, yeah. I have pulled a muscle. It's in my back.
I'll see how much of that time I leave in there on the edit. They're just letting the listener know it was protracted.
You might lengthen it. It was really no longer than 17 seconds.
Very nice. All right. What about you, James?
Same order, but different reasons, I suppose.
Okay.
So I did like the book better. I actually was able to read this book in a day.
Mm-hmm.
With not too much alcohol involved.
A day, wow. That's...
Yeah, I think it was actually, it was a day, probably about late morning to early afternoon.
Nice.
Situation. But I did like the 1962 movie on mm-hmm. Prime. I would totally recommend that movie. That was cool. And then the 80 movie next, because the music was awesome. And the 44 movie last, because it was just terrible.
Okay. Right. Well, I am going to vary from you guys, and I'm going to put the 62 movie first. I did watch it before I read the book, and I feel like it's a good enough adaptation of it that it improves on it in the fact that it's not boring. Right? I feel like that movie's pretty well paced. The book, maybe if I'd started with the magazine, I would have hated the book, I think, just because it's slightly longer and a little more boring. I did enjoy the book, but I'm going to give the 62 movie the nod. Then I'm going to go 1980. It was more entertaining than the 1944 one. And I think that's down to the performances.
And the
groovy music. Yeah. and you know, it does have a lot more points in common with what comes from the book, and it takes a different direction on some of it. But, mm-hmm. you know, the Lucifer's egg thing was a weird aside. But, I think on the strength of the performances, not because of the adaptational consideration. I support the 1944's movie's choice to answer the question and say, no, none of this stuff was real, but it just wasn't a very good movie. So
we did kind of get what you were saying earlier, where I think you said you were looking for a movie that would take a direction, either not real or real.
Mm-hmm.
We did get that out of the 44 and 80 movies, right?
Yep.
So.
Yeah.
And that's what it looks like. So don't do it.
I mean, your mileage may vary, right? You could I maintain that there is a way to make the 1944 movie type of thing where you answer it and say, no, this was all hysteria, and make a decent movie out of it. There's no way to make it not sexist, though. That's the problem. Like, you essentially are saying that women are irrational if you make that movie. So it would be a difficult one to do.
I wonder if you could write it so that the idea that women are irrational is only held by the main character.
Mm.
Kind of like As Good As It Gets. You know that he's a misogynist and you're not supposed to like him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you did that to the character that is saying, you know, treating his wife that way.
Yeah.
But then you'd have to have another hero.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It'd be an interesting challenge.
I think it would have been more interesting to end the 1944 movie with him deciding and agreeing with his wife that none of this stuff was real. And then for him to go off believing that, and her to kind of have a knowing wink with another lady to know that, you know, yeah, it's real. He doesn't believe it, but it's fine. We'll bear with him because he's just a man.
Yes.
No, I mean, this was a fun one. We haven't done a 3-movie one in ages, it seems like. So.
No.
And especially with a full movie. I mean, full Full book.
Full book, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a book and a novella. Mm-hmm. So we,
right.
This is actually my mistake. We assumed that the novel was the source of the movies and then realized that one of the movies came out before the novel was written.
Yes.
So then we backpedaled a whole bunch. I backpedaled a whole bunch and found the novella and found a copy of what we could read and started reading it. It's like, well, this is almost exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. The part that I read, I thought they were pretty close, minus the beginning.
And yeah. It's slightly out of sequence. And from what I read on that history of publication of it is it's a little sexier in the 1952 one, a little more emphasis on such things. But
So where are we going from here?
Well, from here, if everything works out, this is, you know, fingers crossed. Recently on the Nook Store, the Andromeda Strain came up for sale, and we've done some Crichton in the past.
Yeah.
And it's one that Colin and I've read before. Have you read that one?
Nope.
Okay. And so, but we also saw
I started it this morning.
Oh, nice.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So this is what we're doing next, because we also saw that friend of the show, that one of the authors that we enjoy, who's in the Portland area, at least we think, or at least used to be, Daniel H. Wilson, has written a sequel to The Andromeda Strain called The Andromeda Evolution. And I don't know if it's like there were some notes from Michael Crichton. We'll need to get that information from Mr. H. Wilson, as Colin and I've been referring to him. Because I reached out to him because years ago he did like a Q&A thing for my blog, my now defunct blog. I mean, it's still there, but for Brojitsu, the martial art of sibling smackdown. And so like I had his contact information. I thought, I'm just going to send him an email and say, hey, we're going to be doing this podcast. We'd love to get your thoughts about The Andromeda Strain and the adaptations of it, or just about the Andromeda Evolution and how all that came to be. And I got an email back and he's up for it. So hopefully I don't have to edit this out of in the future, because we still need to figure out the logistics of that. But I'm hoping that we're able to make that happen. It's possible that we end up just doing an Andromeda Strain episode, and then maybe we have a sidebar conversation with Mr. H. Wilson about the new book. In some sense, we're gonna do that though. Another thing that we have dangling out there is my son just read 1984 for school, and so I've been reading 1984, and we've already covered like 3 dystopian classics, I think, and I feel like we should do 1984 as well, even though it's not a cheery book, because it's adapted as well,
right?
Okay. But I feel like it's thought provoking enough, and I've had some really great conversations with Ethan about it, because he finished it, and so at some point maybe we'll cover that one. All right. Anyhow, we'll get out of here. Normally I do a little bumper afterwards, you know, thanks for listening and where you can find the all that kind of stuff. But I can just do it here.
You need to give us a payment pounder's blessing.
I do need to do that. So I will do that after I give the, you know, socials and that kind of stuff. So if you're listening to this on the Hugo's feed and you want to subscribe, search for Take Me to Your Reader. You can follow us on Twitter at Pavement Podcast and let us know how we're doing here. Leave us a review. That'd be great. Or for the Hugo's show. That would be cool too. You can actually support us on Patreon through my Hugo's Podcast Patreon, which is patreon.com/Hugo's Podcast. And, you know, that can help us buy a new microphone every now and then or improve our setup or pay hosting fees or something.
Or buy me a 6-pack.
Could do that. You could buy James a beer. Or 6. But yeah. And until next time, we'll leave you with a Pavement Pounder's Conjure Wife blessing.
Is it going to be sexist and misogynistic?
Oh, yes. Yes. Now that I'm thinking of it. May the road rise up to meet you. And remember, witches be crazy. Okay. Bye, everybody.
What's that?
It's a cool little toy.
So, I feel, Emily, that we were remiss in discussing this movie without you, or all the movies without you. You didn't read the book, so you didn't do the homework. That's why we didn't have you on the call. But, you know, like, we all really liked the 1962 movie, and you were not a huge fan, although you were a bigger fan of it than the other ones.
Yes.
But maybe... Can we get a feminine perspective?
Oh, Lord. I don't know if you want the feminine perspective on this. This is... Yeah, it was just bad all around.
Yes.
You know, like, the whole Me Too movement and feminism, and it's just like, that doesn't exist in any of these films. And I don't know, again, I don't know about the book, but, it's painful to watch as a woman. you know, yeah, it's not good.
So, I mean, I did kind of mention that we're bringing... male perspectives to all this, and so any female listeners might their mileage might vary, and you're agreeing that
Yeah, I feel like hours of my life were lost there in this, you know, penis-centric world, right. You know? It was just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just, like, what you're saying is, like, the baseline sexism of this whole story completely makes it so that you can't really enjoy anything.
It's very difficult to watch as a... Yeah. I feel like it was written by men, for men, and, you know, for the male audience.
Yes. Oh, no more dudes have come into the room.
I know, right?
We've got the peanut gallery back. I'm interviewing your wife about her thoughts about the movies.
If I wanted her thoughts, I'd give them to her.
Another male.
I don't know how well that picked up, so you want to go on record, sir? I'll put this in the post-credits scene. Hey, if you had to rank them, how would you rank them?
Can they all be Fs?
They can, but if you had to, if I forced you...
Okay.
You know, as a man,
right,
forcing some rationality.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, put your feelings aside.
Right. Gosh, yeah. Feminine logic here. So to be very honest, we watch with the 40s version, is that?
Today we watched the 62.
Yeah. So we watched the 40s version before on our own, mm-hmm. and I didn't realize it was a podcast movie, but it was so bad, like, I couldn't even watch and pay attention to it.
Gotcha.
Like,
even though it's like an hour and 10
nails
minutes
on a chalkboard. Gotcha. Just the sexism and, you know, women just, like, completely irrational.
Yes.
And so I don't even remember what I was doing, but it was, you know, like, was painful.
Are you saying that one's on the bottom?
Maybe. Yeah, can I give an F plus? I mean, can we break this down? I would say the 40s version was the worst. Mm-hmm. 80s version was worst plus, you know, above, slightly above.
You're like Keith Olbermann was the worst, worster.
Right, worstest. Yeah. this one today, the 62, was probably the best of the three.
If you have to tell that story, that's the way to do it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So, D plus. Okay. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well,
yeah.
Thank you for absolutely providing that perspective.
Sure. All female kind, you know, weighing in.
All right. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Roll that beautiful disco intro music.
We're crossing streams.
Witches brew. Boiling bubble.
We don't have any disco music.
Are these two podcasts going to annihilate each other if they're crossing streams?
No, there's going to be enough unique material that there won't be a problem. You got rid of the noisy vest.
That's what I was waiting for you to finish.
There we go. Okay. Okay.